Happy feast. Abigail, that was amazing. And I think the acoustics in here really brought it out. So thank you so much. Really, at the feast is so special. We get to hear different types of music and performances, and it really makes the feast. I want to welcome those also on the webcast. Some years ago, I had the opportunity to visit with my in-laws up in Vancouver, and they were unable to attend the feast. And we had a little group meet there, and I know how much that meant. Even though we were listening in, it meant a lot that the people could get together. So, and for those of you who are maybe watching by yourself, you're still part of the Koinonia, you're still part of the family, and welcome. Also, I want to thank the technical crew. When you're doing slides, and I have a number of slides and tying it into the internet and all the rest, I just want to say thank you for enduring with me on that. But before I begin, many of you are aware that my family lost our home in the Eaton Fire in Pasadena. And it was surreal how it started. It started 4.5 miles west of us, and we saw the beginnings of it. And we were east because the winds were blowing 60 to 80 to 100 miles westward, so we thought we're fine. So there was a young couple with a family, and we said, stay with us. But within an hour, we saw this fire going against the wind coming to our home. And we are about 4 blocks from the edge of the mountains. So we watched it, and we watched it. And it was a surreal moment when you see a wall of flame coming down or up. thank you. Coming down, and then the embers, which felt like hot needles hitting you. And so I had my trusty garden hose out. I was doing my best with my trusty garden hose until my son, who's 6'5", stood in front of me and says, it's time to go. And we were more concerned about our neighbors getting them out. We had a 91-year-old man who lived there for 60 years, and he goes, Tad, 91 years, I've lived here 60 years. It never comes down this far. Unfortunately, he lost his home. And before we left, we had a prayer, my wife and I and my son, and said for God to protect our home, protect the homes of our neighbors, and protect the firemen. We went and we watched through the internet our Ring camera at 11:23 p.m. and went dead. And we saw flames before that happened. Our house was gone, but God was there. It was interesting that night as people were fleeing, going to hotels, trying to go anywhere, we get contacted by members of Churches of God. From one of the Churches of God, they reached out to our son and said, we're apartment managers. We have an empty apartment. Come stay here. The owner says to open it up to fire victims, and he lives there to this day. From another Church of God member from a different association, they were flying in from out of state, and they called us up and said, come, stay with us. Our Airbnb, the person in there, has left early. Just left. Come, stay with us. It's ready for you. God was there from that night. And though we lost a home, we gained so many other things. We've received so much support. The emails, the texts, the phone calls. I remember one person texted me and said, sorry to bother you. And I said, thank you. Thank you for bothering me. Because when you're going through the shock of something like that, it was good to reach back and appreciate what you have. And it reminded us of the blessings of the family, the blessings of God's family. And the support has been amazing. Not only from our congregations, LA and Bakersfield, United Church of God, and as we heard, Church of God Network, but also from the faith community at large. Also from our college community of people we went through with college reached out, or work communities, or people we didn't know. I'm on a board of a credit union, and one day a package was delivered to me from people somewhere in the United States, throughout the United States, part of the credit union association, with a package for us to help us during those times. And sometimes I think we get caught up in seeing the evil in the world that we forget that there's good in the world too. And we've seen it and we've experienced it. God was definitely there. And we've had our sadness. We're sad to lose our home because it was a place where we had many church activities over the year, many family activities, many community activities. But we haven't lost our sense of humor. So 2 days, we were up at the house at the property, and there's still smoke coming up. And my wife was talking, I don't remember, a neighbor or someone who came through. And she looked out and she said, you know, in 2025, we are planning to declutter the home. I'm checking that one off our list. And we've had other humorous stories along the way. But we've also had immense support from so many. And your prayers make a difference. Your emails make a difference. Your cards make a difference. Your support makes such a difference. It has been an amazing journey. I couldn't have imagined it that night, where we're at today, and the many blessings we've received. I remember Lauren Osterly wrote a song, and it features our home and pictures from our home the night of the fire from our Ring camera, called Hearts of Sorrow, and how much it moved me. An amazing story. And we receive so much from people we don't know, and we would love to thank. But thanks to all of you. We're beginning the permit process once we get back. You don't carry an extra plan of your home, in life. And so when the house burnt down, after we had to deal with a number of things, and we're ready to go. We're going to rebuild for the sake of our children, for our grandchildren, to let them know that this can't defeat us. And we know with Jesus Christ, with all of you, we're going to make it. And it's going to be a wonderful ride. It'll take a while to get there. We'll have our challenges. But it's been amazing so far. So thank you very, very much, all of you, for your support. Now, there are parts of... I'll start the message now. And I want to thank Nathan O'Malley and Frank Fish for their messages yesterday. They very much tie into what we're going to be talking about today. So there are parts of scriptures we tend to overlook. Books we may not read as often or know as well. And within these pages, God often speaks with hope and relevance to what we individually are going through. The voice of the minor prophets, specifically Zechariah, Hosea, and Micah, are among them. Though their writings are short and sometimes unfamiliar, they address questions that remain deeply important today. How should we live in a world when a world around us is uncertain, divided, in pain? How do we stay grounded in the faith when so much around us seems unstable? And these prophets lived during seasons of crisis. There was Hosea. He spoke of a time when there was prosperity on the surface, but underneath there was spiritual unfaithfulness and social corruption. There was Zechariah. And Zechariah lived during the time of the Jews' return from the exile, when people were rebuilding their cities and their identity. Micah delivered God's message in an era where leadership had failed and the vulnerable were being taken advantage of. Sounds a lot like today, doesn't it? Their message to the people of their day were not reserved for some distant future, but they were meant for daily life at the time, right then and there. In the face of societal instability, economic disparity, and spiritual confusion, God called his people to live with integrity, with compassion, and a renewed sense of purpose. And that same call reaches us today. So we're going today to explore their world very briefly, where they live, and the hope and the vision God provided to them and revealed to them, but also what he expected from them. And in doing that, we'll see a way of life that remains just as relevant for us in this day and age. So the title of today's message is Living Today with the Hope of the Future, the words of Zechariah, Hosea, and Micah for our times. In today's message, we'll be exploring passages from Zechariah, Hosea, and Micah by covering the following. First, historical context, a snapshot of the culture and political and spiritual conditions during the time. God's view of society of time. How does God critique the society? How does he view what was going on? Then the hope of the future, the prophetic promises of restoration and healing and the kingdom of God on this earth. Then the call to action, the life that God desires, the distinct values and virtues God was calling on them to embody, but also for us to embody today. And then the practical application today. How do we live today when we have hope of the future? So let's begin this message by exploring the book of Hosea. The prophet Hosea lived in the northern kingdom of Israel during the 8th century BC, around 750 to 722 BC, just before the Assyrian conquest. His prophetic message used the troubled marriage to Gomer as a metaphor for Israel's unfaithfulness to God through idolatry and covenant breaking. The prophet Hosea lived through the reigns of Jeroboam II in the northern kingdom and Uzzah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah in the southern kingdom of Judah. His ministry spanned the period from the closing years of Jeroboam II's reign, about 753 BC, before the fall of Israel, the northern kingdom, making him a contemporary with the prophet Amos, Isaiah, as well as Micah, as we will discuss later. So what was going on in the northern kingdom at that time? Israel was in decline. After years of prosperity under Jeroboam II, it was weakened due to internal corruption and external threats. Assyrian pressure increased. The powerful Assyrian Empire under leaders like Tilgath-Pileser III, Shalmaneser V, and Sargon II was expanding westward. And Samaria, the capital of Israel, fell in 722 BC to the Assyrians. This ended the northern kingdom, and many Israelites were exiled and scattered. So what was God's view of society of the day? And we're not going to turn to these scriptures. I'm just going to summarize each one. Hosea 4, 1 to 2 talks about lack of faithfulness, truth, and justice. They expose a society where deceit, violence, and injustice prevail, reflecting a deep moral and spiritual collapse. Hosea 4, 12 to 13, there was idolatry and immorality. People turned to idolatry and sexual immorality, and it revealed a broken relationship with God. In Hosea 7, 1 to 2, there's deep-rooted and unrepentant sin. And these verses reveal God's frustration with Israel's persistent sinfulness. Hosea 7, 12, 7 to 8, there was dishonest trade and self-reliance. Israel was condemned for deceptive business practices and arrogant self-sufficiency, mistaking material success for divine approval. The society of northern kingdoms had its challenges, and some of these challenges sound familiar, don't they? However, even when God was pointing out the challenges of society, he provided a picture, a vision of the future, of the millennium. Turn to Hosea 2, verse 18. Hosea 2, verse 18. And I'd like to read from the New Living Translation. I do put these scriptures on when I on the screen if you'd like to follow along, or if you want to follow along in your Bible with your translation. It states, on that day On that day I will make a covenant with all the wild animals and birds in the sky, and the animals that scurry along the ground, so they will not harm you. I will remove all weapons of war from the land, all the swords and bows, so you can live unafraid in peace and safety. Though society had its challenges, a vision of a better day is provided. A time when animals will freely roam, weapons of war will be removed, and people living in peace and safety. Something to hope for. But was that it? Is that it? Just hope for the kingdom? Watch prophecy? And hide ourselves from society? Is that it? No. God desired something from them as well, and it applies to us today as we live with the hope of the future. Hosea 6, verse 6. Hosea 6, verse 6. Hosea 6, verse 6. It states, for I desire mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. This verse calls us to reflect on the true nature of worshiping God, one that is rooted in mercy. In the Old Testament, sacrifices, often animals and crops, as we know, were a prescribed way to atone for sin and a way to worship God. But the prophets and Jesus stressed that these acts were meaningless if performed without mercy towards others. So what is meant by mercy? The Hebrew word for mercy is chesed. And chesed is a Hebrew word that means kindness or mercy or steadfast love. It describes a love that is faithful and generous, and even when it's not deserved. Chesed is not a feeling, not just an emotion. It's love, but it's love through actions, like helping others, forgiving others, keeping promises. In the Bible, it often describes God's love for his people, and it calls the people to show the same kindness and mercy to others. By embracing mercy, God is inviting us not just to do kind acts, but to delight in mercy, to treat others with kindness, forgiveness, and with a commitment to serve and to help, especially for those in need. We can see the need to embrace mercy in the words from Jesus Christ, both in Matthew 9, 13 and 12, 7, which are on the screen, where Hosea 6, verse 6 is referenced, reminding his followers that the promised God's priorities have not changed. Luke 6, verse 35. Luke 6, verse 35. Luke 6, verse 35. It says, but love your enemies, do good and lend. Hope for nothing in return, and your reward will be great. And you will be the sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the unthankful and evil. Therefore, be merciful just as your Father is also merciful. We are to emulate God's mercy in our life towards others. So, what are ways we can show mercy in our lives? We show mercy to those who we feel don't deserve it. Living a way of mercy is forgiving someone who has wronged us, even if they haven't apologized. Chesed goes beyond fairness. It often offers grace, seeks restoration, just as God does with us. Be a constant caring presence in someone's life. Chesed means to stand with, to look out for friends, for families during hard times, even when it's convenient. My family experience chesed. At the heart of chesed is loyal love. It shows up, stays committed, and supports others with patience and compassion. Care for the vulnerable without expecting return. Chesed is to help someone in need, a neighbor, a single parent, the homeless. And it's not for recognition, but it's because mercy moves us to love with action. It mirrors God's heart by caring for the overlooked and the hurting. To show mercy is not occasionally embracing mercy. We just do it once in a while. But God wants us to desire what He values at all times, to align our hearts with His, to love mercy. Let's now turn to the book of Zechariah in light of our message title, Living Today with the Hope of the Kingdom. Zechariah was a prophet and priest who lived in the 6th century B.C., around 520 to 518 in the post-exilic period after Babylonian captivity, approximately 20 years after the Jews first returned from exile. He resided in Jerusalem. What's the historical context here? Well, there was a return from exile. The Jews had returned from exile under the decree of Cyrus the Great, a small, vulnerable province known as Yehud within the massive Persian Empire. They lacked the independence of their former kingdom. Economic hardship installed reconstruction. Despite returning with high hopes, the exiles faced difficult living conditions, including failed crops and economic struggles. And after laying the temple's foundation and the rebuilding project had stopped due to local opposition and the people's misplaced focus on their homes instead of God's house, the hardship led to widespread discouragement, with many feeling God had forgotten them. As a result, they had spiritual apathy and loss of hope. Overwhelmed by the difficulties, the people grew spiritually apathetic, and a sense of hopelessness set in. The glorious restoration promised by earlier prophets had not materialized. What about us? Have we expected prophecies to happen that have not materialized? Have we become discouraged? So what was God's view of the society at the time? Again, we won't turn to these scriptures. First, dishonesty and theft. God's curse, symbolized by a flying scroll, targeted thieves and liars, condemning widespread dishonesty and theft that destabilized the society. There was insincere religious practice. God questioned the sincerity of the people's fasting and feasting, which were performed for self-interest rather than true devotion to Him. There was injustice and an oppression. God commanded to people to uphold justice and compassion, condemning the oppression of widows, orphans, foreigners, and the poor. And there was deceit and unjust practices. The call to speak truth and judge fairly and avoid evil schemes or false oaths suggests that the community was prone to dishonesty, unjust practices, and interpersonal conflicts, which undermined the covenant relationship with God and undermined social harmony. There was idolatry and false guidance. Idols and false prophets misled the people with deceptive guidance, leaving them spiritually lost and oppressed. This was the state of society in Zechariah's time. And yet, God provided a vision, a hope of the future. Turn to Zechariah 14, verses 8 to 9. Zechariah 14, verses 8 to 9. Prior to these verses, God describes a future time when Jerusalem will face intense conflict and divine judgment when nations gathering against it. But he will intervene to protect his people and restore his people and establish his reign. And it states, "In that day it shall be that the living water shall flow from Jerusalem, half of them towards the eastern sea, half of them towards the western sea. In both summer and winter it shall occur, and the Lord shall be king over all the earth. And that day it shall be, the Lord is one, and his name is one." God provided, in spite of what was going on in society, God provided hope, a vision for the people, though they were living in troubled times. But with the book of Hosea, God had a call to action for the people, which is not only, again, relevant in their time, but when we think of what was going on in society then, it's relevant for our time. In other words, how are we to live today with the hope of the future? Turn to Zechariah 7, verses 8 to 9. Zechariah 7, verses 8 to 9. Zechariah 7, verses 8 to 9. And it states, "And the word of the Lord came to Zechariah, saying, Thus says the Lord of hosts, render true judgment, show kindness and mercy to one another." We saw in Hosea that God wanted people to show mercy. He adds to this in Zechariah, by desiring that people also exercise true justice. With regard to the phrase, render true judgments, which is in the New King James Version, we can see exercise true justice. Thus, the second characteristic of how we live today with the hope of the kingdom is to render true judgments. The Hebrew word for judgment or justice that's used here is justice or mishpat. The first use of the Hebrew word mishpat or justice in the Bible appears in Genesis 18:19, and it occurs during the visit of the three men to Abraham, one who is identified as the Lord as well as two angels. Just before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, God reveals his plans to Abraham, emphasizing that he has chosen Abraham to become the father of a great nation, the one that's to walk in righteousness, in mishpat, justice. Genesis 18, verse 16. And I will read from the modern English version. Genesis 18, verse 16. Genesis 18, verse 16. And it states, "Then the men rose up and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to see them on their way. Then the Lord said, Should I hide from Abraham what I'm doing, since Abraham surely will become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth will be blessed in him. I chose him. He will instruct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring Abraham what he promised him. Strong's topical lexicon provides his following background to Mishpat. Under covenant faithfulness and social ethics, Genesis 18:19 sets the program. Abraham's children must keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just. Justice, therefore, is covenantal, not optional. The prophets expose violations of oppressing the poor, perverting courts, abusing widows, orphans and widows. Micah 6:8 instills the ethical demand to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. The Hebrew word mishpat, meaning justice or judgment, reflects a core aspect of God's covenant with his people. And it's a point that it's important for us to consider today, that is that living justly, rendering true judgment, it's not optional, but a required way of life for those who are called at this time. Rendering true judgments is a responsibility that expresses faithfulness to God. It shows that we are faithful to God. It's not merely a moral choice. It's a way of life. To act justly in all situations. To stand up for what's right, even when no one else is doing it. Psalms 89, verse 14. And you don't need to turn there. It says, righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. Mercy and truth go before your face. Mishpat, justice, is a foundation of God's throne. And it should be the foundation of how we live our life. A life of mishpat. A life of doing justly. A life of doing right. Mishpat emphasizes righteousness in action. It's not feeling righteousness or having righteous thoughts. It's doing righteousness. It's doing fairness. It's living in alignment with God's standards, especially how we treat others. Isaiah 1, verse 16. Isaiah 1, verse 16. We'll go to verse 17. It states, wash yourselves, make yourselves clean, put away the evil of doings from before my eyes. Cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice. Seek it. And how do we do that? Rebuke the oppressor, defend the fatherless, plead for the widow. Justice is not a passive or rhetorical term. It's a moral imperative rooted in the character of God. It calls believers to stand against systems of exploitations, to correct wrongs, to advocate for those without a voice. Isaiah challenges any notion of religious life that is detached from social concern, insisting that righteousness must be lived out through compassion, as well as advocacy for the less fortunate. Jesus himself rebuked the religious leaders of the day for obsessing over ritual while ignoring the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. In Matthew 23, verse 23, it's the same issue God addressed through Zechariah centuries earlier. Justice is not an option. It's a value in God's kingdom. It's a foundational one that we should be practicing now. Matthew 5, verse 6. Matthew 5, verse 6. Matthew 5, verse 6. And it states, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled." The Greek word for righteousness here is justice, moral uprightness, and alignment of God's standards. To hunger and thirst after righteousness implies a deep desire for doing God's justice. So when Jesus blesses those who long for righteousness, he is also blessing those who yearn for a world where justice prevails, where the poor are cared for, where the marginalized are lifted up when wrongs are made right. So how can we render true judgments in our daily lives? Lift up those in need. Support for those who are marginalized or overlooked. Volunteering time to organizations that serve the less fortunate. Donate resources like clothes or funds to organizations that look out for the vulnerable. It's looking out also for fellow church members, neighbors, members of our community, and even members of our own families in their time of need. Treat others fairly and respectfully. We make decisions that are honest and impartial. We avoid favoritism and we're willing to speak up when others are treated unfairly. I'm going to tell a story. My younger brother, about 12, when he came home crying, jumped on his bed and sobbed the hardest I've ever seen him. And I kept asking him, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" He finally looked up and he said, "I'm retarded and I want to die." See, my brother was born developmentally disabled. And we looked out for him as a family, and we never treated him differently. But he eventually was integrated back in the day into a public school. And no doubt that day, he heard that he was retarded. If only somebody who was his age 12, and I'm talking to the preteens and the teens here today, if only somebody would have stood up for him, because he didn't ask for his disability. He had the academic ability of a second grader. But nobody stood up for him. If somebody would, that would be true justice. Hopefully our young people are standing up to bullies and looking out for others. Maybe they're by themselves at church, to bring them in, to treat them fairly, and to bring them into the family. Finally, reconcile broken relationships. Pursue peace and justice in personal relationship by making amends and forgiving where needed. Mishpat, by definition, includes justice that restores. It's being willing to own up to wrongdoing. We all make mistakes. And helping others to do the same in love. Now let's explore the book of Micah in light of our message today. Micah was active politically during a political and turbulent and spiritually turbulent time in Israel. He prophesied during the kings of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, which places him roughly between 740 and 686 BC. The name of Micah, originating from Hebrew, holds a profound meaning. Who is like God? The name itself symbolizes the question of whether anybody can truly be comparable to the Almighty. Hosea, Isaiah, Amos were contemporaries. The book of Micah speaks primarily to the southern kingdom Judah, but also at times includes the northern kingdom. Micah came from a small rural town, Moresheth, about 25 miles southwest. What's the historical context of what was going on? Judah remained intact during Micah's time, but it was under constant threat for both Israel and Assyria. King Ahaz of Judah sought Assyrian help against Israel and Aram Damascus and became a vassal of Assyria, compromising Judah's independence. King Hezekiah later led religious reforms and resisted Assyria during his reign. Sennacherib invaded Judah in 701 BC and besieged Jerusalem, but the city was miraculously spared. What was God's view of society at the time? In Micah 2, verses 1 to 2, again, no need to turn there, there was land grabbing and oppression. In Micah's time, the powerful individuals schemed at night to unjustly seize land and homes, oppressing the vulnerable and exploiting their authority. In Micah 3, verses 1 to 3, corruption and exploitation by leaders. Micah condemned Israel's leaders for their corrupt and exploitive practices, metaphorically described as devouring the people through injustice and greed. There was injustice and bribery. Micah denounced the priests, leaders, and prophets for perverting judgment through bribery and corruption, while falsely claiming God's protection. There was dishonest trade and violence. Micah criticized the people's dishonest trade practices, such as using false weights and their violent, deceitful behavior, which brought God's judgment. Finally, in Micah 7, 2, verse 3, there was moral decay and pervasive sin. Micah lamented the widespread moral decay in society, where faithfulness vanished, and rulers and judges and the powerful conspired with bribery and evil. These were difficult times for people. With all the challenges around them, God provided hope. God provided a vision for his people. Micah 4, verses 3 to 4. Micah 4, verses 3 to 4, and I like to read from the New International Version. It states in Micah 4, verses 3 to 4, he will judge between many peoples and will settle disputes for strong nations far and wide. They will beat their swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not live. Shall not take up swords against nations, so nor will they train for war anymore. Everyone will sit under their own vine and under their own fig tree, and no one will make them afraid, for the Lord Almighty has spoken. Though the people lived in difficult times, they were provided a vision of the future, just like in Hosea, just like in Zechariah. But what were the people to do? What's God's call to action? And likewise, how are we to live with the hope of the future? Micah 6, verse 8. Micah 6, verse 8. And it states in Micah 6, verse 8, he has shown you, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of you, to do justly, which we've talked about, to love mercy, which we've talked about, and to walk humbly with your God. In Micah 6, 8, we see the people were to do justly, just like also in Zechariah 7, 9, to execute justice, to practice mercy, just like we saw in Zechariah 7, 9 and Hosea 6, 6. But here Micah adds something, to love mercy. And the third characteristic we should embrace, to walk humbly with God. So what does it mean to walk humbly? The word, the Hebrew word, is hatsuneia from the Greek word sano. And its meaning is to be humble and modest or restrained. When we think of the word humble, we may confuse the word humility as seen with the following examples. We confuse humility with self-devaluation. One may think that walking humbly means to think poorly of themselves, but biblical humility isn't self-hatred. It's knowing our value to God, heirs to the kingdom, his children, while recognizing our dependence on him. Using humility to avoid responsibility or action. People might avoid leadership, decision-making, or speaking the truth out of a sense of false humility, thinking it's more spiritual just to stay silent. But true humility doesn't avoid action. It acts under God's authority with wisdom, not personal pride. Sometimes we equate humility with people-pleasing. One may believe their walking humbly means you never stir the bucket. You never confront others, always yielding, keeping the peace at all cost. However, humility doesn't mean being passive. It includes courageous honesty and doing what's right, even when it's hard. To walk humbly with God means to live a way of life that shows that we trust him, that we listen to him, and know that we need him. We don't do the walk alone. It's not about putting ourselves down. It's about letting God lead our lives instead of always trying to be in control. To walk humbly means obeying him quietly and faithfully without showing off or seeking praise. It also means treating others with kindness. In simple terms, it means living each day walking with God, walking with Jesus Christ as he guides our steps. Micah calls us to walk humbly with God, and Paul echoes this same spirit in Philippians 2, verses 3 to 5, urging believers to adopt the humble mindset of Jesus Christ. Philippians 2, verses 3 to 5. It states, "Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem others better than themselves. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but for the interests of others. Let this mind be in you, which is also in Christ Jesus." Philippians 2, verses 3 to 5 urges believers to act with lowliness of mind, with humility, valuing others above themselves, adopting the mindset of Jesus Christ, who embodied selfless service. It closely aligns with the mean in the hatsuneia, walking humbly, from Micah 6, 8, which calls for the quiet, faithful walk with God, marked by humility rather than pride or self-promotion. Living humbly is modeled by Jesus Christ's example of washing the disciples' feet. It's performing acts of kindness, helping those in need. Sometimes it's listening and hearing somebody and taking the time to listen to what they're going through. And it's done without seeking any sort of recognition. It's viewing them as they are. They're imperfect, but so are we. And we perform these acts of service because it is seeking Jesus Christ living within us rather than personal achievements. Like the people in the days of Hosea, Micah, and Zechariah, we are all faced with a world full of challenges. While society today may not be worshiping ancient idols, it often elevates materialism, power, self-interest above all else, effectively a modern-day idol worship. In our society, we also plainly see man's inhumanity to man. We see corruption. We see injustice. We see a drift of moral values around us, which only seems to be accelerating day to day. Yet not everyone in society is defined by these evils. Many in the world strive to try to live a good life as they can, to do the right thing, to raise families, to be good citizens, to look out for one another. We experience that in our life with the loss of our home. So many reached out to us, people we will never know, to help us through a challenging time. And we see people out there in organizations that help the underserved. So this shouldn't surprise us, because we know that humankind is made in the image of God. Genesis 1:27. Still, they are caught in this earth, as we are, in a world that's lost its way, with far too much pain, far too much suffering, far too much sadness, far too much fear, far too much injustice. Amid this, what does God do? What does God do for his people? He offers hope, a vision of the kingdom, a promise of a future time, not only for us, but for all humanity. We see the promise of peace and safety in Hosea, living waters flowing for Jerusalem as Jesus Christ rules this earth, as it's seen in Zechariah, and righteous judgment with weapons of wars being turned into agricultural tools in Zechariah. We are living with the vision of the kingdom while here at the Feast of Tabernacles. But hope alone, vision alone is not enough. And just as in the time of the prophets, we are called to do more than just passively exist, passively watch prophecy, passively watch the news. We are to be active. We are to be active with our neighbors, letting them see the light. We are to be active in our communities, showing Jesus Christ through us. We are called to action with the hope of the future by rendering true justice, loving mercy, and walking humbly with Jesus Christ in the world, in our neighborhoods, in our communities, with people made in the image of God. Yes, there are some who are bad actors. We understand that, and we have seen that in the communities of Altadena and Pasadena as a result of the fires. But many are trying to do their best. And yet we have the promise. We have the vision. We have the hope. And we should be, through our example, showing that light, that they may see the light of Jesus Christ in us, not because of us, but we reflect God in us. This call to action is rooted in Hosea 6:6, where it says, "For I desire mercy, not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings." The knowledge of God, that Elohim, is not just an intellectual understanding, but a deep, transformative relationship with God. It shapes our life through open communication with him, through prayer, through studying his word, taking our time once in a while just to reflect our thoughts and communicate with God what is going on, and also aligning our actions with his will. It seeks God's guidance in decisions, and it responds to the challenges, which sometimes we're not so good doing, with patience and trust. Through the knowledge of God, our relationship with God, and the hope of the kingdom, we are called to live justly. We are called to love mercy. We are called to walk humbly with our God because we show the light of Jesus Christ through us. Matthew 5, verse 14 through 16 states the following. You are the light of the world, like a city on a hilltop that cannot be hidden. No one lights a lamp and then puts it under a basket. Instead, the lamp is placed on a stand where it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your good deeds shine out for the church. No, it says shine out for all, not just our family, not just our fellow church members, to see. And why? So that everyone will praise your Heavenly Father. We are to be a light to all, to those who live in the world that the Father loves so much that he gave his Son to be sacrificed. And we do that in order for them to praise the Father, to know that there's something more than the here and now. In a world that's lost, for many that don't have the hope of the kingdom, that don't have a view of God, a belief in God. So let's hear the prophet's call to action. Let those words shape who we are, how we treat others and engage in our communities, and how we walk alongside one another towards the kingdom with our elder brother, Jesus Christ. Have a great remainder of the feast. And once again, thanks to all of you for the support you have given my family during this time of rebuild. And as my wife is calling it, a new adventure. Not an adventure we were planning on at this day and age, but it's a new adventure. And it's been an amazing one. And we are looking forward to getting the permits done and breaking ground, hopefully in a couple months. So thank you very much.